Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Jeffrey M. Brian presiding, case numbers A-19, 1559, and 1560, State of Minnesota respondent versus Robert Brady Malone appellant.
Good morning. I'd like to make sure that everybody can hear and see just as we hope they can. Is everybody able to hear me okay?
Appellant can, yes.
All right, great. And then I will turn to Judge Riley.
I can hear you. Can everyone hear me? And I put my video back on. Can you see me?
Appellant counsel can, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Cheetah and Mr. Hansen. I think you're muted.
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Judge Johnson?
Yes, I can see and hear everybody so far. I think I'm good.
Good.
Mr. Hansen?
Yes, I can hear everybody and see everybody.
And Mr. Cheetah?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Great. And we're able to hear counsel fine as well. I will make one more comment, and that is that if you see there is one of the screens is displaying a phone that will have your timer. If you're not able to see it, you might want to, in the top right hand of WebEx, you can see that there's different ways to toggle through views. So if you move to the grid view, then that will always be in place. But if instead you're on the active speaker view, sometimes you don't see that screen. And I want to make sure council is able to see how much time is remaining. It should display at this point. It's counting down around 14:30. Council, are you able to see that?
I am not at the moment.
I am.
You are now? Or Mr. Hansen is able to? Mr. Cheetah, if you're able to kind of hover over in the top right-hand corner, there's a circle with four squares inside of it. Or it could be a circle with a large square and then like a ribbon on the bottom. If you toggle to the one that has the grids, then you should be able to see the timer. You see that?
I've gone between those different views. I'm still not able to see the... Oh, I'm sorry. I do see it.
Okay, great. All right, and council, are we ready to proceed?
We are. Appellant is, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, yes, go ahead, Mr. Cheetah.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'm Rod Cheetah, representing the appellant in this matter, Mr. Robert Brady Malone. I wanted to begin with a discussion of some of the investigations that Judge Benshoof had engaged in. Basically, the three investigations that I'm looking at are the investigation into the EFS, the e-file and service database, to determine whether Mr. Malone's attorney had opened up any documents. The other second investigation was the district court judge reviewing an audio hearing from June 11th, 2018. And the third one was the district court's judge of investigating during a live hearing about how Danko's might be served by court administration.
Mr. Cheetah, this is Judge Riley. While you're discussing those, I have three questions that I'd like you to answer with regard to that. The first one is, did you assert the 22 alleged violations that you are asserting here on appeal? Did you argue each of those 22 violations to the district court? So that's my first question. And then the second question is two parts. And do you think that we apply an abuse of discretion standard in deciding whether or not the district court erred in denying your motion to remove, or whether we look at each of the alleged 22 violations using a de novo standard of review?
Thank you. So with respect to the three investigations that we that we talk about. I believe I simply cut and paste from the original district court filings and expanded on that, made additional legal arguments. So I believe we did raise all the issues. As far as, so the main code rules that we're arguing here on these investigations are 2.11. Basically, we're looking at, is there any impartiality there? And that's not just personal knowledge. Personal knowledge is, of course, just a subset of that. And then, of course, the rule 2.9, which is the investigations themselves, the rule stating that a judge shall not investigate facts in a matter independently and shall consider only the evidence presented and any facts that may be properly judicially noticed. So I'd like to get 2.11 out of the way because I think it's somewhat of a red herring, but I think this was misconduct under 2.11 because the rule, clearly what is okay is if the judge is aware of passing general knowledge that was acquired during prior proceedings, and that's what Dorsey, our Minnesota Supreme Court, really hit on, that we've got to accept the fact that judges will acquire this passing general knowledge of even evidentiary facts that are relevant in a matter over which they will eventually preside, right? And so the eventually and the passing are the terms that we're hitting on there. And so the example I give is that if a judge had watched appellant or someone similarly situated walk up and receive a no contact order in court, and the person was later charged with a violation of that no contact order, perhaps that same judge could preside over that trial. But you have to ignore that you have that passing general knowledge. You cannot go and collect evidence, acquire evidence in real time, and announce the results of your investigations. And that's what occurred here. And this was on the day of a motion to dismiss and a jury trial. And the investigations here were not anything that was introduced by the parties. This was completely independent investigations. Parties hadn't planned on introducing any of this evidence. So to announce those things, that's clearly in violation of the bright line investigation rule under 2.9. But if we back up to 2.11, you know, the personal knowledge theory, it's not a privilege to investigate and bolster the state's case in real time. And there's no examples of case law that this is acceptable. One of the cases that we talked about in our brief is the West matter. And again, it hits on those things. Was the information acquired at a prior judicial proceeding? And was it also admitted as evidence during the later trial proceedings? And as court, if we talk about the electronic database that our district court judge investigated, that was not acquired by the judge in a prior proceeding, and it was not admitted as evidence by either party. The audio of the old hearing, that was acquired, the district court judge during a prior proceeding? Well, I think he was the judge at the time, but he had to go and get a tape to determine what occurred there, right? And so in the West case, it was simply, I think the transcript of the perjury, or it was a perjury charge. And of course they were looking at the sentencing transcript, which was in and of itself the criminal charges. And so there was really no worry there, but in this case, we have a judge going back, looking at something that's really not at the forefront of the case. The parties haven't brought it forward. And so he's investigating those things. And was that admitted as evidence by either party? The answer is no. The alleged mailing by court administration, the same thing. This is not anything that Judge Benshoof had acquired at a prior proceeding. There's zero evidence of that. And was it admitted as evidence by either party? And the answer to that is also no. So each of these three investigations, even under 2.11, where we're just talking about overall impartiality, where personal knowledge can be a potential example, it's only a subset in 2.11. But if we look at these three things, we consider them all together, even if there's some aspects of that meets the criteria for personal knowledge, which I don't believe we have here, but even having the three here, having the historical proceedings where Judge Benshoof is saying, look, I can't condone these deliberate violations of the Danko. He said that well in advance of Trier, deliberate violation, right? And he's talking about the Danko charge that he ultimately
reviewed the she would have been the assistant chief's order under an abuse of discretion standard. What standard do we review her order under?
I believe that it's all de novo, because if a reasonable lay examiner would look at the judge's conduct and say this raises in my mind a question as to the impartiality of the judge, then that's the standard that this court has as well, to look at all the particular instances of what we claim are misconduct. And so, Judge Yan ultimately concluded that, you know, Judge Benchoff just made his rulings, and we talk in our brief about her not addressing certain issues. But the one thing she did say was that this was Judge Benchoff's work as a judge. And that was sort of the argument, the conclusion that she made. While we don't believe that that's factually accurate, it's just too far, too broad a brushstroke, and it doesn't address the conduct in any meaningful way under the code. And so
What about the state's argument that you waive these arguments because you agreed to proceed with Judge Benchoff after these earlier hearings?
Well, again, there's really no example that I can find in state law where you can waive these things. And the Baskerville case isn't going to help us get there, because it was under a different standard. It was a civil case. And so today we would have to look at whether these violations occurred. And again, from a lay examiner standpoint, and determine whether or not there was that sort of overarching impartiality. And should we have moved prior to the date of trial for these things? I don't know. I guess we second guess ourselves all the time as attorneys. But I presume that Judge Benchoff could that he knew these things, but that it wouldn't affect the case. We wouldn't see Judge Benchoff doing additional investigations, announcing things to the parties that not only might have injured appellant, which is what the case law uses, might. These things actually did injure appellant. For example, Judge Benchoff ruled that this was not credible. He used the word perjury a couple of times. And while I strenuously disagree with that, all we can deal with is what's in the record. And these things were not in the record. And so for Judge Benchoff to do these investigations, rely on them in making legal decisions, that's what I think, and then we can look at sort of the history that he had already presented.
Let me stop you there. You said that he relied on the investigations when making legal decisions. Which decisions are you referring to?
So he ruled on the motion to dismiss prior to trial. Our claim was due process, as well as, hey, there's not sufficient evidence that appellant had seen the only written Danko order from August 31st, but Judge Benchoff ruled right from the bench, wait a minute, we think your client's lying, and therefore, and he expressly said, I can deny your motion, I just don't find your client credible.
And am I right that the standard at that point on the, you know, for a motion to dismiss under Florence is whether there's probable cause? Is that the standard?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor. So it's sort of an honest, strong suspicion that this crime in particular had been committed. Our argument was there wasn't any evidence that he had received, zero evidence that he had received the August 31st order, which says it replaces all prior orders. So we can argue, you know, all day long about what happened at sentencing, the mistakes of the statute and so forth. But at the end of the day, the August 31st, 2018 Danko, the written one, says it replaces everything that happened prior to it, and therefore all orders prior to it. So there couldn't be an order prior to that.
You have not much time left. I'd like to look at the due process question that you raise. And I just want to be clear as to what you're arguing. Are you arguing that that it was as applied, that your client wasn't provided adequate notice and opportunity to be heard because he wasn't given a separate proceeding when the Danko was issued? I want to make sure I understand your argument.
Thank you. So I'm arguing that ultimately there was confusion. And that it wasn't necessarily that this wasn't, you know, we can say notice. And of course he was in court. There was a judge there. The contact issue came up. That's not the kind of notice that the statute talks about. The notice is that we finish the sentencing hearing and then we move on to a separate proceeding. That's what the legislature has required that we do. I know many other states do this. This was part of why the statute is constitutional, because we don't have to deal with the Danko while the judge is punishing us for our crime, right? And so perhaps we would want to produce witnesses at that separate proceeding, but it's all jumbled into the same proceeding. And we do have case law since Ness. It's unpublished, but the courts, this appellate court has said, look, we're confusing people if we don't distinguish between what happens in a sentencing hearing and what happens in a Danko hearing. Now, normally it's been the pretrial hearing for the pretrial Danko versus the Danko itself, but it's the same thing. Statute requires that both pretrial hearings, bail hearings, and sentencing hearings must be separate from the Danko process. And so, for example, you look at the written Danko from August 31st, it says at the bottom, this is the statewide Danko form, by the way, it says it's both a term of your sentence, which is a mistake of law, in my opinion, but at least it says ultimately this, a violation of this order is a crime and may cause you to be arrested and subject to possible further criminal charges. That's kind of the distinction that the judge made in Brewer, albeit in a pretrial setting. The judge set forth the warning that the Danko is different than bail conditions, right? And you could still be placed under arrest. Judge Benchoff didn't do anything to that effect to distinguish what makes the Danko different than the proceedings in the criminal case itself, whether it be a pretrial bail hearing or a sentencing hearing. And so if we look at Milner, was the appellate decision in which the court ultimately said that we shouldn't conflate the two because it could lead to confusion. I can't imagine a case with greater confusion than here, where all the sentencing judge says is, look, we're going to impose, you know, a Danko will follow, or whatever the language was. No conditions, no nothing. None of the language that was in the written Danko that came out later that at least distinguished. And again, there are mistakes of law there in our form. But at least that one said that a violation is a crime. And there's zero evidence, though, pre-trial and even after trial, that the defendant or appellant knew about this. So I'll finish with that unless there are questions at this point.
All right, thank you, Mr. Cheetah. Mr. Hansen.
Okay. May it please the court. Thank you, counsel. I've kind of struggled on where to begin with this one. There are 26 arguments. It's a case that Mr. Cheetah says there's confusion and complexity about. From the state's perspective, it's a fairly straightforward misdemeanor prosecution. There's not a lot of confusion on my part. There was a crime that happened. Dr. Malone was prosecuted for it. He made several motions and arguments to attempt to get the charges dismissed pre-trial. He was ultimately unsuccessful in those. Didn't like the rulings, disagreed with the judge's opinions, has made now 22 alleged judicial code of conduct violations on the trial judge, and is trying to use those to come in and through the back door, get this thing dismissed after a jury came back with a verdict. I don't think it's a complicated case. In reality, I think what I'm going to do is rest on my brief. My arguments are my arguments. I'm here for questions. I took some notes versus from Mr. Cheetah's presentation. I don't think that, I know Judge Riley, you mentioned the the standard of review for the judicial conduct, I think that's de novo myself. I don't think it's abuse of discretion. From my review of the case law, it looks like de novo. But as I say in my brief, you know, you can still use Judge Yon's opinion as guidance. And I think her opinion is very well written and succinctly gets to the point that all of these alleged 22 violations of judicial conduct don't cut the mustard, essentially. Interestingly, I'll point out this is kind of anecdotal, but I know at least in one of the transcripts, counsel for the defendant mentioned referring Judge Benshoof to the Board of Judicial Standards. I checked with them. They're you know, they've made no findings against Judge Benshoof for any of this alleged behavior.
Mr. Hansen, if I could have you kind of address the due process issue as well, before you you know, conclude your remarks about whether the board is investigated. I'd like to put that aside for a minute because let's start with this question. Was there a separate hearing?
I don't know if I know the statute calls for a separate hearing. I know Justice Page in his analysis in Ness talks about the immediately following requirement. And he says, you know, does that immediate following need an open, close, reopen, you know, new hearing? Or does it mean we talked about the criminal aspect and now we've talked about the Danko aspect? And Justice Page and Ness says, you know, hey, if it's clear that we're changing topics, that's going to be enough for the immediately following. And I think that happened here. If your standard is going to be, we stopped recording, the criminal file is done, now we open a brand new record, a new case file, et cetera, then I think technically no. But according to the Ness decision and Justice Page analysis, I don't think we need that.
Do you think there's a difference between a pretrial Danko and I'll call it probationary Danko?
I think the difference would be the court would want to be even more cautious of a defendant's rights as explained to him individually on a pretrial Danko, because you're entering the court system for the first time. That usually happens at arraignment. I think it's very important that on a pretrial setting, it is, you know, explicitly clear the difference between a no contact order and a domestic abuse no contact order or a Danko, and that the violation of the one is merely a conditional release violation, but the violation of the Danko is a new crime. I think that is very important at the pretrial setting. At the probationary Danko setting, I think it's also important, but we're operating under the assumption that all of those explanations have been made at the pretrial setting, probably through, ideally, counsel has made those, advised the client of those rights as well. And the practice in Beltrami is they read the rights at almost every hearing. So it becomes less important at the probationary because of the fact the rights have been explained so many times prior to that. And then also in this case, individually, Dr. Malone signs a probationary agreement, which articulates that the Danko was ordered. But back to Judge Bryan's question on the due process, I think in this individualized case, again, the transcripts show not only was he heard on the issue, he asked through counsel to have the Danko.
I'm going to interrupt a bit because I think the analysis of the statute that uses the language it uses about a separate hearing, about immediately following, I think it's hard to interpret that as ambiguous or hard to give it some meaning here other than what it plainly seems to require. And yes, it, at one level, it's a little silly for a district court judge to tap her foot three times and spin around in the chair and come back and say, now I'm here on this other file. But that's kind of the way the statute to me is written. My question is following up on the Ness case. Maybe you can remind me. My recollection was that that was not as applied, that that was a facial challenge to the statute, and that the reasoning is because the statute permits or requires this separate hearing, that that's why the statute itself wasn't unconstitutional. But that's not our issue, is it? We're dealing with as applied. Was that statute applied to this case such that there was a separate hearing immediately following like the statute requires?
That's fair analysis. I mean, I still think we look at Ness for the purpose of, you know, Justice Page's analysis of, you know, does the defendant understand what's happening? You know, that's the immediately following. You know, has due process been violated to the point where he is completely unaware what's going on? And in this case, as applied, counsel specifically asked, there was a conversation between counsel and Judge Ventruf, you know, we want the Denkel lifted, and this is why, X, Y, Z. Judge Ventruf goes into his analysis on why he disagrees with that, and then the defendant himself states on the record that he adamantly disagrees, meaning he is fully aware of what's happening at that hearing. The as-applied analysis, though it may, appellant's counsel pointed out two unpublished cases where they had analysis on that issue, they're not persuasive here, and this case is different. You know, Dr. Malone knew what was going on.
Before I get to kind of whether or not he had an understanding, I want to know from you, what does the statute require, and does Ness change the meaning of those terms in the statute? And my view of Ness is that the Supreme Court concluded there is a due process problem unless you have this separate hearing. And because the statute provides for a separate hearing, it's not on its face unconstitutional from a due process standpoint. And that's as far as I see Ness going, but it sounds like you're arguing that Ness goes further and interprets the wording of the statute, separate hearing immediately following, to allow any kind of opportunity to be heard is close enough. And that's the part I'm struggling with, and maybe I'm mischaracterizing your interpretation of Ness, but that's what it sounds like to me. I have some concerns that we would be identifying a due process issue in Ness and saying that the reason it's constitutional is because there is a separate hearing or a hearing, and then using that to reinterpret or to give meaning to the statute where it doesn't seem that that's what Ness looked at.
Sure, and I'll just, you know, read right. The nice thing of this interactive presentation, I've got Ness just pulled up right here. I'm looking at, I think, page 183. Thus, on its face, the immediately following language of section 629.75 subdivision 1C ensures that the defendant will receive notice of the conditions to be imposed and an opportunity to challenge those conditions in a constitutionally sufficient proceeding immediately before the court imposes the domestic abuse no contact order. And that happens.
Right. So let me stop you there, because so is it your position that that language is interpreting what immediately following means for purposes of our case today, that the statute has now been interpreted to say immediately following actually just means an opportunity at some point to be heard?
Yes. I mean, Justice Page has it immediately following, right in quotes there. You know, so that's my position. Yeah. You guys can, of course, disagree with me, but that is the state's position on this.
Mr. Hansen, isn't this case sort of like State versus Schleens? That was a case cited in appellant's brief, not cited in your brief, but it's a case from the Sixth District where the district judge had an ex parte conversation with the prosecutor before a motion to... before a hearing at which it was anticipated there would be a motion to withdraw the plea, and the district judge on an ex parte basis gave the prosecutor some advice about being prepared to introduce certain evidence. I mean, it seems like the proceedings here might be construed as a suggestion about what evidence the state ought to introduce in the future, and that the district judge was providing some assistance to one party at the to that party's advantage, to the disadvantage of a different party.
Well, again, and that's where on the ethical violations, these are de novo reviews. I will let the record speak for itself on that. I'm not an advocate for Judge Benchu or against him. That is for your determination. I don't think in this particular case it rose to that level. I don't think my prosecutor at the time of trial used any of what Mr. Shida is suggesting Judge Benchu did on our behalf.
Well, isn't it true that the state introduced one or more, at least one additional witness at trial who did not testify at the hearing on the motion to dismiss?
I would, I'll just ask for clarification, which witness are you referring to?
I believe it was the probation officer or some other correctional officer.
Yes, the probation officer was, did testify at the trial. I don't know if we would have called her at the motion to dismiss level anyway. I don't think that was we didn't call that witness on the suggestion of Judge Benchu. I know that. That would have been on all of the ethical issues, I will let the record rest, reflect itself. I mean, I'm not the arbiter or the one to lay judgment on Judge Benchu. That is a little bit above my pay grade, I think. I see I have a minute left. Again, I will just reiterate that I think the case is a lot more simple than appellant makes it out to be. And I will simply ask that the court consider my brief, and I will rest on the arguments in my brief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, counsel. Mr. Chita, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, I believe the state brought up something about the ethics board. The ethics board basically said, Judge Benchoff already, well, based on Judge Yon's ruling, Judge Benchoff already knew the practice for mailing Dankos, or the court administration practice for serving folks with Dankos. So they left out, 95% of the issues we've raised here and there. But with respect to the 5%, they also got it wrong, because Judge Benchoff indicated, I don't know how Judge Yon made that finding. Judge Benchoff already knew the practice. The only evidence in the record here is that Judge Benchoff during the jury trial proceeding, or during the motion that immediately preceded it, says to his clerk, "That's what I want to know. Would the document be mailed directly to the defendant?" There's no evidence in the record. So this is not a reasonable lay examiner looking at the text of what's being said here. It's apparently Judge Yon using whatever extra record judicial history or knowledge she has about Judge Benchoff. It's just not simply in the record. And with respect, and ultimately to Judge Johnson's question, this was used to deny the motion. Judge Benchoff said if he was mailed the orders, Mr. Chita, he knew. And then after trial, of course, he said, "Well, we don't have an answer for that question." And Mr. Malone was served with the Danko after he was convicted of it. So I disagree with this finding that he already knew something. And frankly, it would still be a failure on the personal knowledge theory within 2.11. But it's also an investigation under 2.9. So 2.11 is a little bit of a red herring. I'd just like to talk about one other ethics issue quickly. And that was this fact that Judge Benshoff had directed his clerk to arrange what I believe was a secret dialogue with a prosecutor, a backroom prosecutor, over the lunch break about what Judge Benshoff was obviously perceiving as a state witness problem that he needed to help solve, right? Prosecutor Frank was not litigating this case. He was not the trial attorney. So when Judge Benshoff's clerk states to the court administrator, judge wants you to call Prosecutor Frank and give him a heads up on this. They may want to discuss this over the lunch break. And of course, the court administrator says, Dave Frank. And the judge's clerk says, he's wondering if we are subpoenaed, would someone have to then? Yes, Dave Frank. Notice the use of the word we, which means that Judge Benshoff is consciously controlling a group of potential prosecution witnesses through his trial clerk. Would the defense have been in on that secret communication between Judge Benshoff and Prosecutor Frank? No, he wasn't the prosecutor trying the case. Mr. Thielen, who was the prosecutor trying the case, wouldn't have been in on the conversation. So the partiality argument here, I think, is just very, very deep. And the state provided no evidence, no factual evidence, no documents, no witnesses, didn't call in Judge Benshoff to explain any of this. So we have to deal with what's in the record. And Judge Yan indicated this was just, there just wasn't evidence that Judge Benshoff contacted or actually reached the court administrator. That was not the argument. I would just like to conclude by saying that, the question here is, I think the answer, can we regulate the conduct of other judges? To this point, the answer is no. But thankfully for the criminally accused, we have the rules of judicial conduct. We have the case law. We have the case law, Dorsey from the Minnesota Supreme Court. This was wrong. These investigations were wrong. And I think we need judges who are able to service right over wrong, to service precedent, transparency, and the rule of laws that we already have. And I think it's also important that people are treated fairly, that they, even people with little experience, or perhaps more so folks with little experience in the criminal justice system, the victims of these cases, they see what's happening, and this only estranges them from the safety nets that we've constructed for them. And that's frankly, to some degree, what happened here. And so reversal is warranted here on issues of guilt or innocence, the Constitution, as well as this judicial favoritism that was very widespread. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will take the opinion under advisement and issue, or take the case under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.